Dr. Careri stepped forward quickly and picked up the tube Barbara had dropped. Glancing at it before handing it back to her with a polite bow, he exclaimed, "Hello, what's this? Morphine." He picked up another one from the table. "And strychnine. May I ask, my dear young lady, where you got hold of these lethal little tubes?" He began to examine the contents of the tin box. Barbara looked at the suave Italian with distaste. "The spoils of war," she replied shortly, with a tight little smile. Rising anxiously, Caroline Amory approached Dr. Careri.
"They're not really poison, are they, Doctor? I mean, they couldn't harm anyone, could they?" she asked. "That box has been in the house for years. Surely it's harmless, isn't it?"
"I should say," replied Careri dryly, "that with the little lot you have here, you could kill roughly 12 strong men. I don't know what you regard as harmful."
"Oh, good gracious,"
Miss Amory gasped with horror as she moved back to her chair and sat heavily.
"Here, for instance," continued Careri, addressing the assembled company. He picked up a tube and read slowly from the label, "Strychnine, hydrochloride, 1/16 of a grain. 7 or 8 of these little tablets, and you would die a very unpleasant death indeed, an extremely painful way out of the world." He picked up another tube, "Atropine sulfate." "Now, atropine poisoning is sometimes very hard to tell from ptomaine poisoning. It is also a very painful death." Replacing the two tubes he had handled, he picked up another. "Now here," he continued, now speaking very slowly and deliberately, "here we have hyoscine hydrobromide, 1/100th of a grain. That doesn't sound very potent, does it? Yet I assure you, you would only have to swallow half of the little white tablets in this tube, and—" he made a graphic gesture. "There would be no pain. No pain at all. Just a swift and completely dreamless sleep. But a sleep from which there would be no awakening." He moved towards Lucia and held out the tube to her as though inviting her to examine it. There was a smile on his face, but not in his eyes. Lucia stared at the tube as though she were fascinated by it. Stretching out her hand, she spoke in a voice that sounded almost as though it were hypnotized. "A swift and completely dreamless sleep," she murmured, reaching for the tube. Instead of giving it to her, Dr. Careri glanced at Caroline Amory with an almost questioning look. That lady shuddered and looked distressed, but said nothing. With a shrug of the shoulders, Careri turned away from Lucia, still holding the tube of hyoscine hydrobromide. The door to the hallway opened, and Richard Amory entered. Without speaking, he strolled across to the stool by the desk and sat down. He was followed into the room by Treadwell, who carried a tray containing a jug of coffee with cups and saucers. Placing the tray on the coffee table, Treadwell left the room as Lucia moved to pour out the coffee. Barbara went across to Lucia, took 2 cups of coffee from the tray, and then moved over to Richard to give him one of them, keeping the other for herself. Dr. Careri, meanwhile, was busy replacing the tubes in the tin box on the center table.
"You know," said Miss Amory to Careri, "you make my flesh creep, Doctor, with your talk of swift, dreamless sleep and unpleasant deaths. I suppose that being Italian as you are, you know a lot about poisons."
"My dear lady," laughed Careri, "is that not an extremely unjust, what do you say, non sequitur? Why should an Italian know any more about poisons than an Englishman? I have heard it said," he continued playfully, "that poison is a woman's weapon rather than a man's. Perhaps I should ask you—" "Ah, but perhaps, dear lady, it is an Italian woman you were thinking of, hm? Perhaps you were about to mention a certain Borgia. Is that it, eh?"
He took a cup of coffee from Lucia at the coffee table and handed it to Miss Amory, returning to take another cup for himself.
"Lucrezia Borgia, oh, that dreadful creature. "Yes, I suppose that's what I was thinking of," admitted Miss Amory. "I used to have nightmares about her when I was a child, you know. I imagined her as very pale, but tall, and with jet-black hair, just like our own dear Lucia."
Dr. Corelli approached Miss Amory with the sugar bowl. She shook her head in refusal, and he took the bowl back to the coffee tray. Richard Amory put his coffee down, took a magazine from the desk, and began to browse through it, as his aunt developed her Borgia theme.
"Yes, dreadful nightmares I used to have," Miss Amory was saying. "I would be the only child in a room full of adults, all of them drinking out of very elaborate goblets, and then this glamorous woman, and now I come to think of it, dear, she did look remarkably like you, Lucia, dear, would approach me and force a goblet upon me. I could tell by the way she smiled somehow that I ought not to drink, but I knew I wasn't going to be able to refuse, and somehow she hypnotized me into drinking, and then I would begin to feel a dreadful burning sensation in my throat, and I would find myself fighting for breath. And then, of course, I woke up."
Dr. Corelli had moved close to Lucia. Standing in front of her, he gave an ironic bow.
"My dear Lucrezia Borgia," he implored, "have a mercy on us all."
Lucia did not react to Corelli's joke. She appeared not to have heard him. There was a pause. Smiling to himself, Dr. Corelli turned away from Lucia, drank his coffee, and placed his cup on the center table. Finishing her coffee rapidly, Barbara seemed to realize that a change of mood was called for.
"What about a little tune?" she suggested, moving across to the gramophone. "Now, what shall we have? There's a marvelous record here that I bought up in town the other day."
She began to sing, accompanying her words with a jazzy little dance. "Ikey, oh crikey, what have you got on? Or what else is there?"
"Oh, Barbara, dear, not that vulgar song," implored Miss Amory, moving across to her and helping to look through the gramophone records. "There are some much nicer records here. If we must have popular music, there are some lovely songs by John McCormack here somewhere. Or what about the Holy City? I can't remember the soprano's name. Or why not that nice Melba record? Oh, yes, here's Handel's Largo."
"Oh, come on, Aunt Caroline, we're not likely to be cheered up by Handel's Largo," Barbara protested. "There's some Italian opera here, if we must have classical music. Now, come on, Dr. Corelli, this ought to be your province. Come and help us choose."
Corelli joined Barbara and Miss Amory around the gramophone, and all three of them began to sort through the pile of records. Richard now seemed engrossed in his magazine. Lucia rose, moved slowly and apparently aimlessly across to the center table, and glanced at the tin box. Then, taking care to establish that the others were not observing her, she took a tube from the box and read the label, hyoscine hydrobromide. Opening the tube, Lucia poured nearly all of the tablets into the palm of her hand. As she did so, the door to Sir Claude's study opened, and Sir Claude's secretary, Edward Raynor, appeared in the doorway. Unknown to Lucia, Raynor watched her as she put the tube back into the tin box before moving over to the coffee table. At that moment, Sir Claude's voice was heard to call from the study. His words were indistinct, but Raynor, turning to answer him, said,
Yes, of course, Sir Claude. I'll bring you your coffee now.
The secretary was about to enter the library when Sir Claude's voice arrested him.
"And what about that letter to Marshall's?"
"It went off by the afternoon post, Sir Claude," replied the secretary.
"But, Raynor, I told you—" "Oh, come back here, man," Sir Claude boomed from his study.
"I'm sorry, sir," Raynor was heard to say as he retreated from the doorway to rejoin Sir Claude Amory in his study. Lucia, who had turned to watch the secretary at the sound of his voice, seemed not to realize that he had been observing her movements. Turning, so that her back was to Richard, she dropped the tablet she had been holding into one of the coffee cups on the coffee table and moved to the front of the settee. The gramophone suddenly burst into life with a quick foxtrot. Richard Amory put down the magazine he had been reading, finished his coffee quickly, placed the cup on the center table, and moved across to his wife.
"I'll take you at your word. I've decided. We'll go away together."
Lucia looked up at him in surprise.
"Richard," she said faintly. "Do you really mean it? We can get away from here? But I thought you said, what about... where will the money come from?"
"There are always ways of acquiring money," said Richard grimly. There was alarm in Lucia's voice as she asked,
"What do you mean?"
"I mean," said her husband, "that when a man cares about a woman as much as I care about you, he'll do anything. Anything."
"It does not flatter me to hear you say that," Lucia responded. "It only tells me that you still do not trust me, that you think you must buy my love with—"
She broke off and looked around as the door to the study opened and Edward Raynor returned. Raynor walked over to the coffee table and picked up a cup of coffee as Lucia changed her position on the settee, moving down to one end of it. Richard had wandered moodily across to the fireplace and was staring into the unlit fire. Barbara, beginning a tentative foxtrot alone, looked at her cousin Richard as though considering whether to invite him to dance, but apparently put off by his stony countenance, she turned to Raynor. "Care to dance, Mr. Raynor?" she asked. "I'd love to, Miss Amory," the secretary replied. "Just a moment, while I take Sir Claudius' coffee." Lucia suddenly rose from the settee.
"Mr. Raynor," she said hurriedly, "that isn't Sir Claude's coffee. You've taken the wrong cup."
"Have I?" said Raynor. "I'm so sorry." Lucia picked up another cup from the coffee table and held it out to Raynor. They exchanged cups.
"That," said Lucia as she handed her cup to Raynor, "is Sir Claude's coffee."
She smiled enigmatically to herself, placed the cup Raynor had given her on the coffee table, and returned to the settee. Turning his back to Lucia, the secretary took some tablets from his pocket and dropped them into the cup he was holding. As he was walking with it towards the study door, Barbara intercepted him.
"Do come and dance with me, Mr. Raynor," she pleaded with one of her most engaging smiles. "I'd force Dr. Corelli to, except that I can tell he's simply dying to dance with Lucia."
As Raynor hovered indecisively, Richard Amory approached. "You may as well give in to her, Raynor," he advised. "Everyone does, eventually. Here, give the coffee to me. I'll take it to my father." Reluctantly, Raynor allowed the coffee cup to be taken from him. Turning away, Richard paused momentarily and then went through into Sir Claude's study. Barbara and Edward Raynor, having first turned over the gramophone record on the machine, were now slowly waltzing in each other's arms. Carelli watched them for a moment or two with an indulgent smile before approaching Lucia, who, wearing a look of utter dejection, was still seated on the settee. Carelli addressed her.
"It was most kind of Miss Amory to allow me to join you for the weekend," he said.
Lucia looked up at him. For a few seconds she did not speak, but then said finally,
"She is the kindest of people."
"And this is such a charming house," continued Carelli, moving behind the settee. "You must show me over it sometime. I am extremely interested in the domestic architecture of this period."
While he was speaking, Richard Amory had returned from the study. Ignoring his wife and Corelli, he went across to the box of drugs on the center table and began to tidy its contents.
"Miss Amory can tell you much more about this house than I can," Lucia told Dr. Corelli. "I know very little of these things."
Looking around first to confirm that Richard Amory was busying himself with the drugs, that Edward Raynor and Barbara Amory were still waltzing at the far end of the room, and that Caroline Amory appeared to be dozing, Carelli moved to the front of the settee and sat next to Lucia. In low, urgent tones, he muttered,
"Have you done what I asked?"
Her voice even lower, almost a whisper, Lucia said desperately,
"Have you no pity?"
"Have you done what I told you to do?" Carelli asked more insistently.
I...
Lucia began, but then faltering rose, turned abruptly and walked swiftly to the door which led into the hall. Turning the handle, she discovered that the door would not open.
"There's something wrong with this door," she exclaimed, turning to face the others. "I can't get it open."
"What's that?"
called Barbara, still waltzing with Raina. "I can't get this door open," Lucia repeated. Barbara and Raina stopped dancing and went across to Lucia at the door. Richard Amory moved to the gramophone to switch it off before joining them. They took it in turns to attempt to get the door open, but without success, observed by Miss Amory, who was awake but still seated, and by Dr. Corelli, who stood by the bookcase. Unnoticed by any of the company, Sir Claude emerged from his study, coffee cup in hand, and stood for a moment or two observing the group clustered around the door to the hall. "What an extraordinary thing!" Raina exclaimed, abandoning his attempt to open the door and turning to face the others. "Seems to have got stuck somehow." Sir Claude's voice rang across the room, startling them all.
"No, no, it's not stuck. It's locked. Locked from the outside."
His sister rose and approached Sir Claude. She was about to speak, but he forestalled her.
"It was locked by my orders, Caroline," he told her.
With all eyes upon him, Sir Claude walked across to the coffee table, took a lump of sugar from the bowl and dropped it into his cup.
"I have something to say to you all," he announced to the assembled company. "Richard, would you be so kind as to ring for Treadwell?"
His son looked as though he were about to make some reply. However, after a pause, he went to the fireplace and pressed a bell in the wall nearby.
"I suggest that you all sit down," Sir Claude continued with a gesture towards the chairs.
Dr. Corelli, with raised eyebrows, crossed the room to sit on the stool. Edward Raynor and Lucia Amory found chairs for themselves, while Richard Amory chose to stand in front of the fireplace, looking puzzled. Caroline Amory and her niece Barbara occupied the settee. When all were comfortably seated, Sir Claude moved the armchair to a position where he could most easily observe all the others. He sat. Door on the left opened, and Treadwell entered.
"You rang, Sir Claude?"
"Yes, Treadwell."
"Did you call the number I gave you?"
"Yes, sir."
"Was the answer satisfactory?"
"Perfectly satisfactory, sir."
"And a car has gone to the station?"
"Yes, sir."
"The car has been ordered to meet the train."
"Very well, Treadwell," said Sir Claude. "You may lock up now."
"Yes, sir,"
replied Treadwell as he withdrew. After the butler had closed the door behind him, the sound of a key turning in the lock could be heard.
"Claude," Miss Amory exclaimed, "what on earth does Treadwell think—"
"Treadwell is acting on my instructions, Caroline," Sir Claude interrupted sharply.
Richard Amory addressed his father.
"May we ask the meaning of all this?" he inquired coldly.
"I am about to explain," replied Sir Claude. "Please listen to me calmly, all of you. To begin with, as you now realize, those two doors," he gestured towards the two doors on the hall side of the library, "are locked on the outside. From my study next door, there is no way out except through this room. The French windows in this room are locked."
Swivelling around in his seat to Carelli, he explained, as though in parenthesis,
"locked, in fact, by a patent device of my own, which my family knows of, but which they do not know how to immobilize."
Again addressing everyone, Sir Claude continued,
"This place is a rat trap." He looked at his watch. "It is now 9:10. At a few minutes past 9, the rat catcher will arrive."
"The rat catcher?"
Richard Amory's face was a study in perplexity.
"What rat catcher?"
"A detective," explained the famous scientist dryly, as he sipped his coffee.
Consternation greeted Sir Claude's announcement. Lucia uttered a low cry, and her husband stared at her intently. Miss Amory gave a shriek. Barbara exclaimed, "Crikey!" And Edward Raynor contributed an ineffectual, "Oh, I say, Sir Claude." Only Dr. Corelli seemed unaffected. Sir Claude settled in his armchair, holding his coffee cup in his right hand and the saucer in his left.
"I seem to have achieved my little effect," he observed with satisfaction.
Finishing his coffee, he set the cup and saucer down on the table with a grimace.
"The coffee is unusually bitter this evening," he complained. His sister's countenance registered a certain annoyance at the aspersion cast on the coffee, which she took as a direct criticism of her housekeeping. She was about to say something when Richard Amory spoke. "What detective?" he asked his father.
"His name is Hercule Poirot," replied Sir Claude. "He is a Belgian."
"But why?" Richard persisted. "Why did you send for him?"
"A leading question," said his father with an unpleasantly grim smile. "Now we come to the point. For some time past, as most of you know, I have been engaged in atomic research. I have made a discovery of a new explosive. Its force is such that everything hitherto attempted in that line will be mere child's play beside it. Most of this you know already."
Carelli got to his feet quickly.
"I did not know," exclaimed eagerly. "I am much interested to hear of this." "Indeed, Dr. Carelli." Sir Claude invested the conventionally meaningless phrase with a curious significance, and Carelli, in some embarrassment, resumed his seat. "As I was saying," Sir Claude continued, "the force of Amorite, as I call it, is such that where we have hitherto killed by thousands, we can now kill by hundreds of thousands."
"How horrible!" exclaimed Lucia with a shudder.
"My dear Lucia,"
her father-in-law smiled thinly at her as he spoke,
"the truth is never horrible, only interesting."
"But why," asked Richard, "are you telling us all this?"
"Because I have had occasion for some time to believe that a member of this household was attempting to steal the Amorite formula. I had asked Monsieur Poirot to join us tomorrow for the weekend so that he could take the formula back to London with him on Monday and deliver it personally to an official at the Ministry of Defence."
"But, Claude, that's absurd. Indeed, it's highly offensive to all of us," Caroline Amory expostulated. "You can't seriously suspect—"
"I have not finished, Caroline," her brother interrupted. "And I assure you there is nothing absurd about what I am saying. I repeat, I had invited Hercule Poirot to join us tomorrow, but I have had to change my plans and ask Monsieur Poirot to hurry down here from London this evening. I have taken this step because—"
Sir Claude paused. When he resumed speaking, it was more slowly, and with a much more deliberate emphasis.
"Because," he repeated, as his glance swept around the assembled company, "the formula, written on an ordinary sheet of notepaper and enclosed in a long envelope, was stolen from the safe in my study some time before dinner this evening. It was stolen by someone in this room."
A chorus of shocked exclamations greeted the eminent scientist's announcement. Then everyone began to speak at once.
"Stolen formula?" Caroline Amory began.
"What, from the safe? Impossible!" Edward Raynor exclaimed. The babble of voices did not include that of Dr. Carelli, who remained seated with a thoughtful expression on his face. The others, however, were silenced only when Sir Claude raised his voice and continued.
"I am in the habit of being certain of my facts," he assured his hearers. "At 7:20 exactly, I placed the formula in the safe. As I left the study, Raynor here entered it."
Blushing either from embarrassment or from anger, the secretary began,
"Sir Claude, really, I must protest."
Sir Claude raised a hand to silence him.
"Raynor remained in the study," he went on, "and was still there working when Dr. Carelli appeared at the door. After greeting him, Raynor left Carelli alone in the study while he went to let Lucia know—"
"I protest, I—"
Carelli began, but again Sir Claude raised his hand for silence and continued his narrative.
"Raynor, however," he said, "did not get further than the door of this room, where he met my sister Caroline with Barbara. The three of them remained in this room, and Dr. Carelli joined them. Caroline and Barbara were the only two members of the party who did not enter the study."
Barbara glanced at her aunt and then addressed Sir Claude.
"I'm afraid your information about our movements isn't quite correct, Uncle Claude," she said. "I can't be excluded from your list of suspects. Do you remember Aunt Caroline? You sent me into the study to look for a knitting needle you said you'd mislaid. You wondered if it might be in there."
Ignoring his niece's interruption, the scientist continued, "Richard came down next. He strolled into the study by himself and remained there for some minutes."
"My God!" Richard exclaimed. "Really, Father, you surely don't suspect that I'd steal your wretched formula, do you?"
Looking directly at his son, Sir Claude replied meaningfully, "That piece of paper was worth a great deal of money."
"I see." His son regarded him steadily. "And I'm in debt." "That's what you mean, isn't it?"
Sir Claude made no reply to him. His gaze sweeping over the others, he continued, "As I was saying, Richard remained in the study for some minutes. He reappeared in this room just as Lucia came in. When dinner was announced a few minutes later, Lucia was no longer with us. I found her in the study, standing by the safe."
"Father!"
exclaimed Richard, moving to his wife and putting an arm protectively about her.
"I repeat, standing by the safe," Sir Claude insisted. "She seemed very much agitated, and when I asked what was the matter, she told me she felt unwell. I suggested that a glass of wine might be good for her. She assured me, however, that she was quite all right again, and then left me to join the others. Instead of following Lucia immediately to the dining room, I remained behind in my study. I don't know why, but some instinct urged me to look in the safe. The envelope with the formula in it had disappeared."
There was a pause. No one spoke. The immense seriousness of the situation appeared to be dawning on everyone. Then Richard asked, "How have you assembled this information about our movements, Father?"
"By taking thought, of course," Sir Claude replied. "By observation and deduction. By the evidence of my own eyes, and by what I learned from questioning Treadwell."
"I notice you don't include Treadwell or any of the other servants among your suspects, Claude," Caroline Amory observed tartly. "Only your family."
"My family and our guest," her brother corrected her. "That is so, Caroline. I have established to my own satisfaction that neither Treadwell nor any of the domestics were in the study between the time I placed the formula in the safe and the time I opened the safe again to find it missing." He looked at each of them in turn before adding, "I hope the position is clear to you all. Whoever took the formula must still have it. Since we returned here from dinner, the dining room has been thoroughly searched. Treadwell would have informed me if the piece of paper had been found hidden there. And as you now realize, I have seen to it that no one has had the opportunity to leave this room."